And those processes of being an other for me in the United States were obviously very fundamental to shaping who I am as a person and as a writer. And it was a very difficult experience to undergo, but it, you know, to become a writer who could talk about those issues was also a lot of fun. And writing The Sympathizer was a lot of fun. And I hope that the novel was enjoyable and humorous to read, despite its very serious politics. And when I wrote The Committed, I also had a lot of fun. As an outsider to France, in writing the novel itself, The Committed, there was a lot of humor. And humor, satire, these kinds of tools to confront the tragedy of othering is very important to me as literary and political devices. I think I could do that in both The Sympathizer and The Committed because I had a lot of distance from the time periods that those novels describe. My challenge right now is to try to find my sense of humor in describing what the United States is undergoing and doing to other countries and to its own immigrants and its own people of color and its own minorities in the present. That's proving to be a little more challenging at this moment. So the whole power of the state is geared towards dividing and conquering, whether it's domestically within a state, whether it's exercising its power overseas and things like colonization, which is all about dividing and conquering. So in the face of that, to engage in expansive solidarity and capacious grief is to work against the mechanisms of colonialism and militarism and the state. It's enormously difficult, which is why it has to be rebuilt from every generation, because every generation is subject to the power of the state and its ideologies and its mythologies and so on. So I think the lessons that I've extracted from that in this book, To Save and to Destroy, where I talk about expansive solidarity and capacious grief, these are lessons that, again, have been learned by other people before me, but lessons that I had to learn for myself and to put into my own words. So as a writer, I do believe that art and literature in and of themselves are important. One of the most important reasons why is because language is crucial. Part of the way that states and authoritarian regimes exercise their power is not just through physical violence and intimidation, but through a maltreatment of language itself. I mean, Trump is a perfect example of this. Everything that comes out of his mouth in terms of language is horrifying for anybody who has any sensitivity to language. You know, the excesses of his language in terms of insults, in terms of hyperbolic praise for his sycophants and so on. It's a perfect example of how language is used by an authoritarian and by the state in order to obfuscate reality and in order to intimidate people. But that language is ugly from my perspective. And so there is something about being committed to literature and to art that awakens us to the importance of beauty. And I think about what John Keats, the poet, said, beauty is truth, truth, beauty. You can't separate these kinds of things. So if you're committed to the beauty of language, you're also committed to this idea that language has a relationship to truth. And you can see that authoritarians don't have a relationship to truth. They have a relationship to the abuse of truth because language is one of the most crucial ways that authoritarianism extends its power. What I've discovered as a writer is that fear is a good indicator that there is a truth. To speak the truth in a society is oftentimes an act that requires some courage.
Viet Thanh Nguyen has spent much of his life exploring the stories we tell and the stories we erase about war, migration, and memory. His 2015 debut novel, The Sympathizer, about a communist double agent in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, won the Pulitzer Prize and a long list of other major literary awards. In 2024, The Sympathizer was adapted into a critically acclaimed HBO series directed by Park Chan-wook. Nguyen followed it with The Committed and his latest work, To Save and Destroy, Writing as an Other, a meditation on writing, power, and the politics of representation. Nguyen is also the author of Nothing Ever Dies, a finalist for the National Book Award in Nonfiction, and the short story collection, The Refugees. He's edited collections like The Displaced, Refugee Writers on Refugee Lives, and most recently, the Library of America volume for Maxine Hong Kingston, who was once his teacher. He was born in Vietnam, came to the United States as a refugee, and is now a professor at the University of Southern California. He's received Guggenheim and MacArthur Fellowships, honorary doctorates, and has been named a Chevalier by the French Ministry of Culture. Today, we'll talk about his books, America's Forever Wars, and how the act of writing, across fiction, memoir, and scholarship, can become both a form of resistance and a way of making sense of being, as he puts it in his memoir, A Man of Two Faces. Viet Thanh Nguyen, welcome back to The Creative Process.
Thanks so much for having me, Mia.
So it's been 50 years since the end of the Vietnam War, and it really feels like
We haven't learned the lessons. We now have war with Iran. I even heard the other day Jeffrey Sachs say that he thinks America is aiming in a few years to start a war with China. The signals are there. And it's at this time when empire is declining that it wants to pick fights with everyone. In actual wars, it's tariff wars, wars against universities. When do you feel we'll learn those lessons, and will it be too late?
I think the indication is that at least a large portion of the United States has not learned those lessons. And unfortunately, that portion is in power. The Trump administration is certainly taking these wrong lessons to a level that will probably lead us to all kinds of war. We're already at war with immigrants. That's the explicitly stated goal of the Trump administration. And there's an internal war against these immigrants, an acceleration of the militarization domestically of the United States, which is an indicator of how much more military aggression in terms of foreign policy the United States will exercise. But let's be clear that this is an outcome of Democratic policy, too. The Democrats have been wholehearted supporters of the forever war. Democrats have been responsible for a lot of the wars that the United States has fought in the post-World War II era. The Democrats have also given legitimacy to extrajudicial drone strikes and to the militarization of the police domestically. So even if the Republican Party under Donald Trump is accelerating things, the Democrats have also been very complicit in a lot of this as well. So yes, we are an empire that is past its peak, that is struggling to hang on via force and violence versus diplomacy and negotiation. These are very, very bad signs, but they're also repetitions of things that the United States has been doing fairly consistently in the post-World War II era.
Yeah, the whole war economy, you know, it makes me laugh. I mean, just to that point about China, for whatever it's done or human rights abuses and these things, it hasn't invaded countries and not on this yearly level that America does overtly and covertly. I don't want to just talk about that, but, you know, you've written anti-imperialist books, so I think it's relevant to mention. In your book, To Save and Destroy, you explore what it means to be the other. This book was originally delivered as the Norton Lectures. You also critique the structures of representation and power, like we were discussing. And you say empires and war machines deploy the language of neutrality, bureaucracy, and symmetry to disguise the impact of their asymmetrical policies and weaponry. You've said that writing is your way of fighting, of grieving. And how hard is it to actively dismantle those constructed languages of neutrality and to really get at the heart of the true asymmetry, the colonial, neocolonial power, rather just offering a counter-narrative, but to get at the heart of it?
Well, I think it's extremely difficult because these languages express a logic of rationality, of impartiality. You know, the assumption is that, of course, the United States or France or other kinds of Western imperial powers have the legitimacy to do what they do because they embody these universal principles, supposedly, of rationality and justice and fairness and the like, that the Western empires are bringing to the rest of the world. And of course, the way that the Western imperial states have brought these ideas to the rest of the world is through violence. That if non-Western and non-imperial states don't agree to these principles of the Enlightenment, then they will be punished very violently. But if you live within the heart of Western empire in countries like France or the United States, it's very difficult to get outside of these assumptions, whether you are a citizen, a native-born person, or whether you're an immigrant who's come to these countries, and obviously to embrace these values at the same time. And so I think that I'm hardly the first one to point out the use of language in this way, and I'm very far from the first person to point out the entrenchment of Western colonialism and imperialism in terms of the language of democracy and enlightenment and civilization. I just recently finished rereading James Baldwin's No Name in the Street, and he was saying these things in the 1940s, the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s. And despite the impact of Baldwin's ideas and his reputation, we're still doing the same things that he criticized in that whole mid-century period. His pessimism in 1972, when he published No Name in the Street, when he said, essentially, that it's the end of the West, but the end of the West will be held off with what he called holding actions that will be very bloody and violent. And he used the phrase seas of blood. I mean, he was extremely pessimistic in 1972 with the Vietnam War not yet concluded. His pessimism is pretty warranted. And then the issue that we're facing is that these mechanisms of empire and otherness are so deeply entrenched that Baldwin's vision of the decline of the West is simply taking a very, very long time.
Yeah, exactly. You know, poetry is powerful. You know, the beauty of Baldwin's language, of your language, is powerful. But sometimes to speak to power, I don't know, you need a hammer. So America's only just over 4% of the world population, declining empire, all the signs are there, but is also the largest military power. So what happens at that mix? Can it stand to be in the second or third or fourth position?
If we look at a country like France, which is in the second position at this point, we can see how difficult it was for France to lose its empire. And that's, again, what Baldwin is documenting. No Name in the Street begins in 1948 in Paris as Baldwin shows up. And he witnesses the decline of the French Empire as it loses its war in Indochina and as it's waging its war in Algeria. And he talks about how incredibly violent France is at this time. Domestically, he's witnessing the abuse of Algerians, of Arabs, of anybody who does not look white in France as the French Empire turns its energies not just against Algerians in Algeria, but against anybody who's suspect within France itself. What he depicts, what he describes, like the militarized police on the streets carrying machine guns, kidnapping people off the streets, beating them in the presence of white French people without any repercussions, spearing them away to camps, and people not being able to do anything about it, it's almost exactly like what the United States is doing today. You know, France went through a very long period of unrest, of violence, as it lost its grip. And even today, obviously, if we look at France, we can see how the nostalgia for French empire is still dominant in terms of how domestic French politics are being played out. So even a second-rank imperial state like France still struggles with what it means to lose global power. And so I think it's going to be an extremely ugly period as a first-rank empire, the United States, is forced to come to grips with its decline. The United States is not willingly coming to grips with that. It's being forced to through the global competition posed by other countries. Whatever we think of those other countries, it's a different issue. But the United States is itself not giving up its privileges gracefully at this point, and the consequences will be extreme, not just for the United States itself, but for every other country that it interacts with.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen the BRICS nations grow from like 12% in just a few years to, I think it's 52% now, maybe close to 55%, and I only see it growing larger, which I think it's good to counteract that power. But yeah, it must be very unsettling for America. But speaking of France, last time you came on the show, you had just recently published The Sympathizer and you were working on its sequel, The Committed. So in The Committed, the protagonist is the man of two faces and two minds. And he's, you know, embodying this displacement first in The Sympathizer that's set between Vietnam and America, but now in The Committed, he comes to France. He's another colonial subject, still oppressed, existing in a subordinate state where we were the unwanted, the unneeded, and the unseen, invisible to all but ourselves. I mean, how do you navigate that kind of existential and political implications of describing the journey of this character despite the geographical shifts, searching to finally find a place where his multiple selves might come?
Well, you mentioned the other book that I wrote, or the lectures, To Save and to Destroy, Writing as an Other. And those processes of being an other for me in the United States were obviously very fundamental to shaping who I am as a person and as a writer. And it was a very difficult experience to undergo, but it, you know, to become a writer who could talk about those issues was also a lot of fun. And writing The Sympathizer was a lot of fun, and I hope that the novel was enjoyable and humorous to read despite its very serious politics. And when I wrote The Committed, I also had a lot of fun. As an outsider to France, I was an other in some ways, but certainly not in the most dramatic sense, which is what I was depicting in the novel. That is, the other who was an Algerian, who was an Arab, who was North African, who was Black. I think those experiences of otherness within France are not something that a tourist experiences, but something a tourist can only witness from afar. So some of the things that Baldwin saw, I actually saw glimpses of as well. I mean, Baldwin describes watching an Algerian being beat in front of a French cafe. And I have to say, I saw the exact same experience with a Black man being beat in front of a cafe in central Paris, and people just watching and not doing anything about it. And the police were just completely free to do whatever they wanted. It was shocking for me to see that. At least in the United States at that time, this was the early 2000s, the police had the sense to just beat people in places where white people couldn't see that happening. But in France, it was like, well, we'll just beat you in the streets of central Paris where the tourists can see it and where white French people can see it. It was shocking. So there was no humor in that. But in writing the novel itself, The Committed, there was a lot of humor. And humor, satire, these kinds of tools to confront the tragedy of othering is very important to me as literary and political devices. I think I could do that in both The Sympathizer and The Committed because I had a lot of distance from the time periods that those novels describe. My challenge right now is to try to find my sense of humor in describing what the United States is undergoing and doing to other countries and to its own immigrants and its own people of color and its own minorities in the present. That's proving to be a little more challenging at this moment.
Yeah, because you don't want the humor to wallpaper over all the injustices. And then you've mentioned there the different experiences. Of course, you've written about this Carpathian grief and having solidarity with the oppressed around the world. And yet sometimes that solidarity is hard. And I feel like, you know, in your books and also in your son's name, Ellison, there are echoes there of the invisible man. And you describe different racial dynamics, say in France, you talk about in Paris, where maybe us as Asian Americans or of Asian descent, we might just be kind of invisible, that model minority, but the Black and Arab immigrants really, you know, racism operates in a different way across those different colonial contexts. So how did you first open up to this capacious grief? And how is it others, not to be prescriptive, but not everyone knows how to find their way into it?
I think the answer relates back to one of the earlier questions about language and the power of the state. And what happens is that if you are someone who believes in the power of language and in things like capacious grief and expansive solidarity, you're building these things from an artistic practice and the practices of social and political movements from civil society and so on. Whereas the state has all of its enormous power, the power accumulated by tax dollars that it can put into government apparatuses, into the police, into the military, into the border and customs officials and so on. The entire power of the state is mechanized in order to divide people through the use of actual geographical borders to separate one nation from another, but also with domestically within a nation to divide populations from each other, to say that population A is different than population B. These are different kinds of minorities, for example. You have nothing in common. You should identify with the state and what it's doing and so forth. So the whole power of the state is geared towards dividing and conquering, whether it's domestically within a state, whether it's exercising its power overseas and things like colonization, which is all about dividing and conquering. So in the face of that, to engage in expansive solidarity and capacious grief is to work against the mechanisms of colonialism and militarism and the state. It's enormously difficult, which is why it has to be rebuilt from every generation, because every generation is subject to the power of the state and its ideologies and its mythologies and so on. So I think the lessons that I've extracted from that in this book, To Save and to Destroy, where I talk about expansive solidarity and capacious grief, these are lessons that, again, have been learned by other people before me, but lessons that I had to learn for myself and to put into my own words. How I came to those lessons, it came about from starting with understanding my own location as a minority person within the United States, understanding that who I was not simply an American and not simply a Vietnamese, but very much a person of color, a minority, someone whose racialized condition is also connected to my colonized condition coming out of Vietnam as well. And once I could understand that, and that process took place initially through thinking of myself as an Asian American, once I could understand that, then I could start to gradually expand my political and cultural consciousness to see that I have links to what Asians in France have undergone, but also what Black people have undergone globally, what Latino immigrants have undergone within the United States, what, you know, Latin Americans have experienced through American foreign policy that was being enacted at the same time that the U.S. was doing terrible things to Southeast Asia. All these things are connected. And the challenge is that in order to be able to build these connections, so people like me have to do a lot of work. I had to do a lot of reading. I had to do a lot of talking with people. And, you know, most people just don't have the time to do that. And so that's how the power of the state does its work. The power of the state, you know, has the ability to broadcast its ideology and its mythology to everybody, but everybody has to do this work of decolonization, of anti-racism, of political awakening individually. And so that's why it has to happen generationally, from one generation to the next.
Yes, and you speak of the power of language and the power of literature. And we should also say you are also prolific with your journalism and knowing when that is a tool to use. When we're talking about broadcast or these kind of public talks, how you're going to best reach the audience to be most effective. So I want to thank you for that. Can you speak about the paradoxes of otherness in that, you know, writing can in certain ways lead you to ascend to this insider status. And then you wonder, like, who are you writing for? So you've said consistently your obligation is to speak as if everyone could already understand what you said, instead of just translating for a white audience or just giving them something palliative instead of a real mirror in which not just the white audience, all of us, because we are complicit in different ways, you know, a way to confront these truths.
So as a writer, I do believe that art and literature in and of themselves are important. So I'm going to keep on writing novels. And one of the most important reasons why is because, as you mentioned, language is crucial. Part of the way that states and authoritarian regimes exercise their power is not just through physical violence and intimidation, but through a maltreatment of language itself. I mean, Trump is a perfect example of this. Everything that comes out of his mouth in terms of language is horrifying for anybody who has any sensitivity to language. You know, the excesses of his language in terms of insults, in terms of hyperbolic praise for his sycophants and so on. It's a perfect example of how language is used by an authoritarian and by the state in order to obfuscate reality and in order to intimidate people. That language is ugly from my perspective. And so there is something about being committed to literature and to art that awakens us to the importance of beauty. However you choose to define beauty, that's a very subjective definition. But I think every artist is committed to beauty. And I think about what John Keats, the poet, said, beauty is truth, truth, beauty. You can't separate these kinds of things. So if you're committed to the beauty of language, you're also committed to this idea that language has a relationship to truth. And you can see that authoritarians don't have a relationship to truth. They have a relationship to the abuse of truth and to lying, not only in content, but in the form of their language as well. So there's a really crucial role for writers here and our relationship to language, because language is one of the most crucial ways that authoritarianism extends its power. So the other reality, unfortunately, is that many people, maybe most people, don't read novels. So I could keep on writing novels, of course, and I think that in and of itself is important, but how do I reach audiences that don't read novels? And so in my case, I think I have accumulated enough cultural capital so that even people who don't read novels think I have something important to say. Now, whether that's true or not, I'm going to exploit that and write articles, not just for people who read literature, but for people who read the Financial Times in the UK or Time Magazine in the United States. These are probably middle-brow publications read by intelligent people who are not necessarily literary people, but who are in many ways just everyday citizens doing their everyday lives. And if I can reach them in some way with these articles that I'm allowed to write and to publish because of my cultural capital, I think that's really crucial. And my model here, of course, has been people like James Baldwin or Edward Said or Toni Morrison or other kinds of writers and intellectuals and scholars who have used their cultural capital because of their intellectual accomplishments in order to try to reach non-literary, non-intellectual audiences out there. And that kind of work, I think, is absolutely crucial to what it is that writers can do.
Yeah, and that fluidity is so important. And now talking about writing in another mode, you've now also written a memoir, A Man of Two Faces. I'm just wondering, is someone who really confronts truths, like the journalism, of course, was a kind of truth, but also the truth through novels, how hard was it to write your way into this? You know, you discuss the potential portrayal of telling your parents' stories, your mother's stories. How did you grow comfortable with that? And what did you discover about your own experiences in the writing of the book?
I think what I've discovered as a writer is that fear is a good indicator that there is a truth. To speak the truth in a society is oftentimes an act that requires courage, because every society, I think, is invested in its own kinds of mythologies and ideologies, which involve hypocrisies and absurdities. Every society has its others, its outsiders, its inconsistencies, where its ideals collapse because it has its interests that it wants to exploit, oftentimes at the expense of certain kinds of populations. To speak truth to that means that you are going to confront your society. No society wants to have its hypocrisies, its absurdities, its contradictions pointed out, which means there's always a role for a writer or an intellectual or an artist to speak the truth. And then there's always the possibility of that writer or intellectual or artist being penalized in some ways for what they say. So as a writer, if you encounter fear in your project, it's a good sign that you're somewhere on the verge of a truth that is hard to articulate. That truth could be about your society, but could also be about yourself and your family. And so that has been true for me, writing things that are more explicitly political. Whenever I feel afraid, then I know that is probably something that I need to confront and that overcome. For example, oftentimes I'll give talks to audiences in places that I think maybe they won't like what I have to say. I get very nervous. For example, giving a talk at West Point, the United States premier military academy for training its military officers, I've said many of the same things that I've said to you. And before giving that talk, I was quite nervous, quite fearful, but I felt it was necessary to go ahead and say these things because who else needs to hear this than the military officers of the United States? And likewise, with writing a memoir about my family and myself, this was the most difficult thing I'd ever done. In finishing that book, I felt actually a visceral level of agony that I'd never experienced before as a writer. And by visceral, I mean I felt it in my gut. The first time that I had other people read this manuscript besides my partner, I just felt physically ill because I thought I'm betraying my mother and my family by talking about things that they would rather not have anyone know about. And yet I felt that these things were truthful and that they needed to be said, not just out of some kind of impulse of vanity, but because I think that what happened to my mother and to my family were not just private individual things, but also outcomes of colonialism and racism and war. And for me as a writer, the only place to go is to the place of truth and of fear. And even if I felt physically ill that other people were going to be reading this story, I felt I had to go through with it. And that physical illness was a sign that I was actually on the verge of saying something powerful and true.
Yeah. And in some ways, like the sympathizer, like the committed, in some ways, you were the unreliable narrator in your own life. I mean, the facts you had, the feelings, the trauma you maybe, you know, shielded yourself from in order to survive your childhood. And of course, your family had all these experiences and shield themselves in different ways. But I thought that was interesting to think about the unreliable narrative in our own memoir, in our own lives.
I think we're always unreliable narrators. The interesting question here is the layers of unreliability. Writing a memoir, you have to try to be truthful, I think. Now, if you're writing a memoir for some kind of, you know, instrumental purpose, like you're a celebrity or an actor or a politician, you're trying to sell some version of yourself that benefits your career, then truthfulness or veracity is not necessarily part of what you're doing. But if you're writing a memoir or an autobiography for its most authentic purpose, which is to excavate some part of yourself, you want to try to be truthful. Going back into your own past, you can demonstrate that in some point in your past, you were an unreliable narrator to yourself, and now you've discovered what that unreliability is. And that's part of what happens in this memoir, A Man of Two Faces. But of course, the question always remains, even if I know that I was an unreliable narrator in the past, do I know whether I'm a reliable narrator now? How do we know? I mean, there's unreliability that is intentional, and there's unreliability that is not. And that is the great mystery of our own self that a good memoir, I think, is really designed to explore.
Yeah, and I feel for some people, a lot of my family, forgetting is a way of healing too. And sometimes you can't force everyone to remember things. I mean, that's a scab that maybe they prefer to keep.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot about myself that I am a survivor. I'm literally a survivor because I made it out of Vietnam. And let me phrase this a slightly different way. I mean, there are many people who stayed in Vietnam in the wake of the war. They're survivors too. So just to leave a country doesn't necessarily make one a survivor. However, I think being a survivor is also a relative condition. You know, my family left, but we left behind my sister. So she stayed, we left, and we survived, obviously. But relative to each other, who is the survivor here? There are a lot of Vietnamese people who are left behind who would look at the people of the diaspora and say, you were the survivors. You got to get out. You got to realize these particular ambitions. So relative to those people, I think of myself as a survivor. I'm not a survivor relative to the victorious Vietnamese who really wanted to stay, who chose to stay, and who would see the diaspora as a population of traitors. So I experienced some survivor's guilt in terms of being the one in my family who could leave while my sister was left behind. But I also think of myself as a survivor in terms of being able to deal with the degree of trauma that I had. Not everybody who fled as a refugee, for example, are survivors in that sense, and they made it through alive. I mean, a lot of people did not survive the crossing of the ocean or the land in order to leave a country. So a lot of these people are physical survivors, but they're not mental survivors. They were so deeply traumatized by whatever they've gone through, and they often can't even articulate how traumatized they are, and therefore they're damaged to themselves and they damage other people. And I think I'm a survivor of that because at least I'm able to recognize what kind of trauma I've undergone, as minimal as it might be, and I've tried to repair myself, and I've tried to make sure I don't transmit trauma to my loved ones. That's a form of surviving, and part of it is due to not dwelling on certain kinds of things or choosing when I can dwell on things. Maybe that's a key difference. People who cannot make that choice, they cannot choose to forget. They're stuck in their own trauma. people who can choose to forget deliberately or not, and then can choose to revisit the past as they see fit. That's a survivor's capability that's really fortuitous. And I really don't know where that comes from. And I think that's where, for me, part of survivor's guilt arises, because why could my mother not do that? And why could I do that? I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. I'm just very lucky that happened in my case, and my mother was unlucky, but it couldn't happen in her case. And again, the survivor's guilt is, for me, wrapped up not just with leaving a country and having a different physical and personal reality than my sister, but also a different emotional reality than my mother.
Yeah. And maybe the delaying of facing things, because it's so hard. I mean, I can only imagine for your parents, they built a business. They were so strong and resilient, but sometimes they can't show weakness for their children. They can't show that. And then it catches up with you eventually.
It catches up with you. That's what the past does. So even those people that you mentioned, like of your family, who are able to move on, that they don't dwell in the past, they choose to forget, or they're able to forget. I still think that for these kinds of people, the past still waits for them somewhere, whether they acknowledge it or not. At some deep level, it's still there. And at some point, either they will have to cope with it, or will still manifest itself in ways that they may not be aware of. I've certainly encountered people like that who, on the surface, are very functional people. They have careers and families and all these kinds of things. And they say they choose not to dwell upon the past. But if you just poke them a little bit, ask them certain kinds of questions, they're forced to think about the past for a moment. They seem to realize that, in fact, they haven't left the past behind. They've just managed to contain it in a certain way within themselves, in a sealed room within themselves. But the past is still there, waiting to be cracked open.
Yeah, I think in that way, we're lucky, those of us who are in the arts, we can project it. It's your story, but it can exist outside of yourself. And I think that's a gift in both readers or people who can experience others' art, but also for those of us who make art. So I didn't get to mention, we had Don McKellar here on the show, who was the writer adapting The Sympathizer. And so we discussed that at length. And I just thought it was brilliant, the critique of Hollywood's American war narratives, the auteur, to see it where I had imagined it from the page, the way the four, or we should say five horsemen of the apocalypse kind of embodied in American imperialism. And the casting was great, and the tone and humor of it. And you made a cameo. So what was that like, the whole process of adapting your own novel, which is already interrogating these narratives of filmmaking in mainstream American TV series?
Oh, I'm going to have to listen to Don McKellar's podcast with you. I just pulled it up. But Don and I did a podcast together for the LA Times where we talked about the creative process, and he was a great guy to work with. I mean, it was a very strange and wonderful experience for me because, you know, as a writer, I think most writers spend most of our time in the creative work just alone, in the solitude of our own mind. And with TV or film, that's simply not possible. In order to make a TV series or a movie, the solitude that every collaborator in the show has to undergo, in the end, has to become a part of a public and collaborative process. You work as a team, functional or not, and then you produce something that not any one person can take credit for. And so I take very little credit for The Sympathizer as a TV series, except that I gave them the ideas and the backbone of the story. But so many different people came into play in terms of making that happen, from Don as the head writer to Park Chan-wook as the visionary director and co-producer for the show, to the art design, the set design, the costumes, the hair, the music, the actors, of course, all of that. And so in some ways, I was an other to my own creative product. And it was great because I did not actually want to be involved in very much of the creative process, because I'm humble enough to realize that everything I've described requires enormous amounts of talent that I don't have, including the writing of a TV script, which is its own particular kind of skill, which I could possibly learn, but which would require so much work. So I had to become an other to the creative process for the TV series and trust in these others who were involved. And I could have the luxury of visiting the set as a tourist to my own show. And you know, in the end, what can I say about the TV series? I'm still an other to it because I can't make a critical assessment of it. I'm an other who's completely wrapped up in the outcome of it. So I think it's good. I have no idea if it's great. I have no idea if it'll stand the test of time. But the TV series at least met my vision for what the show should be about. The show should be Vietnamese-centered. It should have mostly Vietnamese actors. Certainly everybody who plays a Vietnamese role is Vietnamese in one way or another. It should be true to the vision of the book. And then outside of that, it's just a complete gamble. And every time you do a collaborative process in TV and film, it's a complete gamble.
Yeah, I love that it captured the absurdity in the humor and all that. You had mentioned before that you didn't think it could be a film, and I think the TV limited series is a great format for bringing across that complexity. And then we're talking about others. There were all so many others involved in it. It was a critique of America, but there's so many outsiders' view. And actually, it's not just a critique of America, it's a critique of so many things. And then we discussed that the whole thing was like a translation process. It was like the Petulant Captain's experience all over again, because you were writing a script, and then it has to be translated between the exchanges with Park Chan-wook. And it was a constant translation and submitting of pages.
Yeah, it was really interesting watching that with a certain kind of distance, because I did participate a little bit in it, because I read all the scripts that Don and his team of writers produced, and I gave notes to Don, some of which he took and some of which he didn't, which was fine. You know, but overall, this is very definitely a Park Chan-wook production. That's how it was marketed. And I thought that was fine because, in fact, I thought Park Chan-wook was the ideal collaborator for this. You know, his movie Old Boy was a stylistic inspiration for The Sympathizer. So it was just a perfect circle. And I couldn't imagine a better collaborator, you know, Park Chan-wook, who was Korean, who has a very sophisticated understanding of history, politics, colonization, war, racism, violence, the dark recesses of one's soul and one's psyche, all of which is manifest throughout his oeuvre. And so I thought it was really ideal. And Don being a Canadian and our producer, Neve Fitchman, being Canadian, the fact that they were white guys, but that they were not American, were so important to the making of this show. And so, yes, it is very much a show that is about Vietnam and the United States, but made in many ways by people who are not Vietnamese and not American, and so therefore distance from the ideologies and the mythologies of both of these nations.
Yes, and is The Committed, is it set for another, I don't know, should I ask that?
Well, yeah, Neve Fitchman was the producer who was the motor that got The Sympathizer started, and obviously in the making of the TV series, so many other producers got involved. Robert Downey Jr. and his partner Susan Downey, A24, and so on. But it never would have happened without Neve putting the option down on the book. An option is when someone pays a certain amount of money to have the rights to try to develop it. And Neve was the one who did that. It was his vision that really drove it. But when Neve optioned The Sympathizer, he really wanted to make it into a movie. And he'd had experience doing this with other books, particularly with two of Jose Saramago novels, Blindness and The Double, which Blindness became Blindness, but then The Double became The Enemy with Jake Gyllenhaal. So I thought anybody who can adapt Jose Saramago novels is qualified to adapt The Sympathizer. But I disagreed with Neve in the sense that I did not think it would be a good movie. I thought it needed a TV series because its inspiration as a novel was at least partly driven by TV series. I watched a lot of TV series as I was writing the novel, you know, contemporary classics like The Wire and The Sopranos and Breaking Bad. And there's already a TV series element to the structure of the novel itself. And there's a lot of ground that the novel covers that couldn't be condensed into 2 or 3 hours. The Committed, however, I think is a different kind of a story. And I think it could be a feature-length movie. So, you know, Neve is out there trying to find the people who can do this. The vision is very much now for a movie adaptation with a much lower budget because the Sympathizer TV series was enormously expensive. And I don't think either of us have that vision for The Committed. So we're in the beginning stages. We'll see if Neve is successful trying to pull this one off.
Hi, my name is Henny Jong, and I study English at the University of Chicago. In one essay in his book, To Save and to Destroy, Viet Thanh Nguyen rejects the notion that each person has to find their own voice, an idea often thrown around in creative writing classes. He rejects this notion because to arrive at your own voice, you must pass through the voices of those you encounter and read and remember. And voices can be scattered, torn, lost in noise. No population or person has ever been voiceless for the closely listening ear. Each person's writing is punctuated by gaps that some once present other voice made in time. I really love this line towards the end of Viet's essay. I may speak for myself and only for myself, but I am perceived as speaking for others whether I want to or not. But between your voice and the voices of those that carry yours, there are still gaps, and they can hurt. It took decades for me to understand what the costs of war were for my mother, Viet remembers. Later on, he asks, Vietnamese people, how do you separate what is unique to you and your own personal trauma from war, colonization, the division or unification of the country? Vietnamese people, how do you separate yourself and your memories from history? As a writer myself, I am fortunate that my family has never been shy about sharing their stories. But then they also constantly said the ugliness of these stories, the terror in them, must stay in the room, which made me feel incredibly uneasy when I learned one particularly unsettling story recently. When my grandmother was just a few months old, the Second Sino-Japanese War broke out and her village was raided. The villagers fled into the surrounding fields. My grandma's mother was afraid that her daughter's cries would give everyone away, so she left my grandma behind on the ground and fled with the others. After some time, my great-grandfather noticed his daughter was missing and ran back through the field to search for her. My grandmother, who is still alive today, has no memory of this and was only told later by her parents. I set out to write about this event in a poem, but across repeated attempts, I couldn't write without it feeling like fiction. I realized I didn't even have an inkling what my great-grandparents were like. I realized I didn't know the emotional costs for my grandmother of being told that story and the cost of not having the memory herself. I realized it was impossible to write about the abandonment without writing about the war, but I didn't really viscerally think of myself as a direct descendant or consequence of that war, and it unsettled me that someone could easily read my writing as some official representative image of what being in that war was like. In other words, I was suddenly made aware that a body that made my body was almost claimed by a history that I couldn't feel on a personal bodily level. The blanks I couldn't fill in nearly drove me to just not write about it at all. But I think something would be lost if I stopped trying to describe that discomfort, trying to articulate the labor of carrying the absent voices that carried me. And over the process, I completely felt what Viet said about writing being adjacent to fear. I think that fear comes partially from being thrown into close proximity to the lost voices that move you into your voice. You are coming close to the people whose actions spoke you into being, and in that sense, literally spoke for you. To write or speak for that someone, in turn, is to dissolve, even to drown, your voice in theirs, and to allow it to take the shape of that disorientation. And I think that is where the individual-centered notion of the poet, as the inspired single person spoken to by the single muse, ends, and where the real music begins. And now, back to the interview.
That's so interesting. And I think you're right. The Television 6 series is perfect for that. And also, I mean, if the goal is we experience it, of course, first as art, but then you also want to engender conversations. I think something about being in our homes, it encourages that. You know, it's something that you live with. It's not just one event. It's over a course. And so I think that that was just the perfect format for that. You've spoken out about the necessary and logical solidarity between Asian Americans and Palestine. And of course, this Carpathian grief and empathy that you have for others all around the world. But the dangers of standing up for the excluded, the oppressed, and the colonized can be portrayed as radical, misguided, and threatening. I'm just wondering, what are your views now of what's going on in Gaza? What is the role of artists and intellectuals in fostering this expansive solidarity?
So there's a particular lecture in To Save and to Destroy that is, you know, that the title is On Palestine and Asia. And the genesis for that was that in the original list of Norton lectures, a lecture that was called On the Death of Asian Americans, and I wanted to talk about anti-Asian violence because this was 2023 when I was going to give this lecture, and we had just underwent COVID, and there was a whole surge of anti-Asian violence and rhetoric globally from the United States to France and many other countries. And I thought it was important then to talk about the othering process for Asian immigrants and Asian Americans, but also Asians in a lot of non-Asian countries. And what happened was that right before I was going to give that lecture, October 7th happened, and I thought I had to respond to October 7th and its consequences. And the fact that I was due to give a lecture on the death of Asian Americans forced me to think about how I could sort of merge these issues of Palestine, Israel, and Asian Americans. And so that lecture talks specifically about the mechanism of othering, that it's universal, so that what was done to the Jews in Germany and through anti-Semitism is also the same kind of process that's being done to Palestinians in Palestine and to other minorities in other kinds of locations. And so the trajectory from othering to genocide is pretty clear. It doesn't mean it's inevitable that it's going to happen, but the logic is already there from the very beginning. And the tragedy of what happens in Palestine and in Gaza, of course, is that one population of people who have been subjected to genocide, or at least their ancestors, are now perfectly comfortable with the possibility of inflicting genocide on another population. And the principle that has been advanced by Jewish people and their advocates to always remember and to never forget is absolutely right. But, of course, what we see is that in application, the principle has been reduced to a mechanism of nationalism. Always remember, never forget what was done to us, but always forget what we do to others. That is the mechanism of nationalism. And so the challenge here is the confusion between the two, right? The necessity of acknowledging that the Holocaust was wrong and we should always be against anti-Semitism, absolutely true. But if we believe in that, we can't give the state of Israel and its supporters any excuse for inflicting the very same thing that was done to Jewish people. And part of the challenge, of course, is that there is an alignment between the state of Israel and the state of the United States and the states of the West. That is now the alignment. So Jewish people as minorities, wherever they find themselves, who are subjected to anti-Semitism, that situation is not the same as the state of Israel and what it does to Palestinians. And that's what that lecture was about. And the idea that if we feel, as we should, capacious grief and expansive solidarity with the victims of anti-Semitism, with Jewish people whenever they experience that, so we should feel that for Palestinians when they're subjected to genocidal hatred and violence as well. And it's very difficult to make that argument when the entirety of the Western world is aligned with Israel and is designed to prevent that recognition from taking place. So it is a very difficult recognition. I don't think it's restricted only to Asian Americans, although I think Asian Americans should have that recognition. But one of the reasons it's important to emphasize Asia in all of this is that Palestine is in Asia. Iran is in Asia. Israel technically is in Asia too, but I think the state of Israel doesn't align with Asia. It aligns itself with the West. And so I think these arguments about settler colonialism and Israel being an outpost of a settler colonial country that is also an outpost of Western imperialism and Western settler colonialism, I agree with that argument. It's an argument that infuriates a lot of Israelis and their supporters in the West, but I think it's true. And so for those of us who see an alignment in our political struggles against racism, against settler colonialism, this is part of what brings us to an alignment with Palestine against a settler colonial Israeli state.
Yeah, and I think that it's changing. I mean, we've seen it on university campuses, even right-wing journalists who supported the war against immigrants, Tucker Carlson and others, Marjorie Taylor Greene. I mean, I was just surprised, but I'm glad that they're finding their conscience on this particular topic. And I'm really tired of being, I think people are waking up to this, being told the AIPAC talking point that Israel is the only democracy in the region when it's an ethnocracy, right? It's a democracy if you're Israeli. It's not for the other half of the population.
I think racism is an interesting process because racism is something that obviously can be directed against immigrants and so on, as we're seeing now. And Tucker Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene, I don't know how critical they are of much of what's being done to immigrants within the United States. But I think back to an earlier example in American history, which is the American colonization of the Philippines. Now, that was a very bloody and violent process that most Americans have forgotten, but this is a colonial war that the U.S. waged from 1898 until 1902 or so that killed about 1 million Filipinos by some estimates, and then led to an American empire in the Philippines up until 1946. But there was anti-imperialism in the United States about this war, and a lot of it was anti-racist and against this idea of empire. But a significant portion of the anti-imperialism in the United States was racist anti-imperialism. There were Americans who were saying, well, we don't want an American empire in the Philippines because there will be Filipinos who can go to the United States. So one of the blowbacks of empire will be that there will be more brown people in the United States. Therefore, we should get rid of the Philippines as a colony. I think that impulse is kind of driving the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Tucker Carlsons of the world. They can recognize that certain things that the United States is doing are not beneficial to the United States. Not that they necessarily have sympathy with non-white peoples, but they're concerned about the blowback that could happen to the United States. Now, I wouldn't agree with these kinds of sentiments, but they do allow a certain kind of ideological alliance to take place around a particular issue. And that's what happened with the Philippines. This alliance around this problem of U.S. imperialism did lead to an act to emancipate the Philippines from the United States by the mid-1930s, which was forestalled by the Japanese invasion of the Philippines, and therefore the Philippines were not allowed to leave the United States until 1946. So going back to your earlier question about Gaza, is there any hope there? Well, yes, I think there is some hope that the degree of vocal opposition to what Israel is doing there, coming primarily from the left, but also now from some parts of the right, gives some hope that we can put an end to the worst parts of this genocide, from mass bombing to mass starvation. And I don't really know what the future foretells. But I think there's been a shift in terms of the degree of American and Western support for Israel, as a larger portion of the West recognizes how much of the state of Israel is built upon a degree of violent occupation and apartheid that could be sustainable, but at tremendous cost to so-called Western ideals. And now those proponents of Western idealism have a choice to make. This is not about the left. It's about people who believe that the West is supposed to stand for certain things. You could get a very perfect illustration that these ideals of Western liberalism are perfectly compatible with violent settler colonialism. We'll see how many people are willing to make a break with that in order to force Israel into some recognition of a Palestinian state, whether it's a two-state solution or a democratic one-state solution.
Well, I certainly hope so. And on that point of having likely allies, I mean, even if it's only for economic interests, or even if it's only that they don't want American soldiers to die, that's often the case. And we saw in Vietnam, you know, the protests, but it was often risk for the American soldiers and their loss of life. But if they find it's too costly because of declining empire and you can't pay all these bills, then, I mean, I'm for that too. Whatever gets us to that point. Talking about turning points, I think, is this your last year as a professor?
Yes, it is.
It is.
Today is June 30th. By June 30th of next year, I should be finished with my professorship, which is a big deal for me because my entire identity as a professional, as a working person, as a son, has been wrapped up with being a professor. This will be my 28th or 29th year as a professor. The reason I became a professor was that it was a way of placating my parents. I never wanted to be a professor. When I was growing up as a refugee child, the word professor never was spoken in our household. Maybe doctor, lawyer, engineer was spoken in our household, but never professor. So I had no idea what I was getting into. And to get a PhD and become a professor was simply to placate my parents, who wanted me to have a job with some kind of prestige. Whereas what I really wanted to do was to be a writer. And so to be a professor has been my day job for nearly 30 years at this point. And it's been great in some ways. It's taught me a lot. And it's allowed me to become a certain kind of a writer that I wouldn't have been, I think, if I did not have my PhD and if I had not been grappling with many of these theoretical and scholarly and philosophical ideas. For that, I'm grateful. But I think I stopped learning anything from being a professor about human nature 10 or 15 years ago. So it's been a matter of paying the bills for the last 10 or 15 years, which has been very dispiriting in some ways. So I'll be forever grateful to being a professor. But the larger mission has always been, as our conversation has been about, what can art do? What can literature do? What can language do? How can using these things make me a better writer, a better thinker about the human condition, but also my own condition? And being a professor no longer serves these ambitions.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, though. I mean, when we're teaching, we're also always learning. And in a way, being a teacher is being a performer and getting that kind of feedback or understanding younger people's perspectives on lessons from history that you're giving. So what has it given to you in terms of that added perspective?
I think, obviously, like many other professors, I could do this until I die. The task of being a professor is always important because there's always a new generation of students coming in who can benefit from whatever insights one might have as a professor, both as a scholar and a thinker, but also as a teacher and as a human being. And so I could keep on fulfilling that role. It is a role that has its own frustrations built into it, because with every generation, the same problems arise of recalcitrant students, students who don't want to learn, students who don't want to be in the classroom. And of course, every professor has to learn how to cope with that. In my case, also, that's compounded by the challenges of AI, ChatGPT, so on. I teach both very specialized courses where the students really want to be there, but I also teach general education courses on the Vietnam War where half the students don't want to be there. And it's very hard to get to them. And so it's frustrating in some ways, expending a lot of energy on something that I really deeply believe in and to feel that I can't reach half of the students in that class. And it's not a new problem, of course, but it is a problem that I can walk away from. The problem of AI is something that all society has to confront, but especially teachers and professors and so on. But I don't have to deal with this. I can walk away and let my former graduate students who are now professors try to figure out how to pedagogically and philosophically deal with ChatGPT and AI. The mission of a professor is something that I'll still carry on because, as you said, the performance aspect, the idea that you can reach audiences and impart new ideas. I do that through just giving a lot of lectures throughout the United States and through a lot of interactions with audiences here and elsewhere in other countries as well. So I think there's valuable work to be done there also that reaches a lot of people who still need these ideas. So it's not only 18 to 21 year olds in universities who need education. It's also the people who come to literary festivals and my lectures and so on that I can try to reach out to as well. And I have to say that trying to speak to audiences within academia was very important in terms of teaching me how to be a public speaker. But then going outside of that, giving talks at West Point, at the State Department, at community colleges, at literary festivals in very conservative parts of the United States, going to different countries, all that has taught me a whole lot of other things about the importance of reaching out as a public speaker and as someone who's trying to engage with audiences as well. The last thing I'll say is that giving up my professorial position frees up a lot of time to do other things that will teach me more. So recently I did a trip to El Salvador. I didn't have the time to do this as a professor because all of my work was focused on Asia. Now I can go to El Salvador. I can be there at the same time that Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, was there signing the deportation agreement with President Bukele as I was investigating the history of U.S.-sponsored massacre in El Salvador. This was enormously crucial, my understanding of how the contemporary United States works and how El Salvador and Central America in the 1980s was absolutely related to what the U.S. was doing in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos during the 1960s and 1970s. So giving up my professorship means hopefully I have more time actually to do the kind of work that motivated me to become a professor in the first place.
Yes, because your curiosity is wide. And I'm glad that you brought up AI, because we have an AI in the Future of Humanity podcast, so we'll be publishing it on that as well. I'm glad you brought up AI because it's threatening so many things, not just the livelihood of writers and artists, journalists. It's used for misinformation, disinformation. It's the new great game. It's in all our devices, listening to us in different ways, and all the big powers are vying to dominate the AI space. So what are your reflections on that? What it means for us as artists, as citizens, journalists trying to get the truth?
Just from the most practical level, it's simply another new challenge to humanity that writers can write about. This has always been the case, that writers have had to confront the dystopian realities that human beings have always produced. So what that would entail, I'm not sure, but I know that there will be great novels about AI in the fantasy and science fiction worlds and also in the more conventionally literary worlds as well. But the threat that AI poses in another dimension, which is the dimension of our everyday lives, like how we make a living, for example, that I think is extremely serious. That's why so many authors are deeply frightened about their own work being displaced. You know, the whole idea was that artificial intelligence would displace the working class and the laboring classes and so on. But apparently AI poses just as much of a threat, maybe even more of a threat to the intellectual laborers of the world. So there's some ways in which your plumber, for example, will not go out of business anytime soon because they cannot be replaced by AI. But your average copywriter, lawyer, and so on, they can be replaced by AI. And so this dystopian reality is a new kind of mortal threat to the intellectual workers of the world. And I don't know what the answer to that will be, but to think that AI could replace us because we are in some senses workers, that opens up a whole new dimension of expansive solidarity and capacious grief if writers and artists can think of themselves as workers as well. Because AI is completely wrapped up with global capitalism, the extraction of profit from labor, and the transformation of everybody into the lowest paid commodity consumer possible, including writers, including the world of the arts. And so I think this is another acceleration of global capitalism that will bring us to new levels of contradiction. The outcome is not clear, because when people are confronted by the losses of their livelihoods, it doesn't make them necessarily into better human beings who are going to unite in solidarity and grief with other people in order to revolt against capitalism. It could turn them into really scared, anxious people, vulnerable to demagoguery. And so I think that this is another choice that's being offered to us and will be offered to even more of us in the next decade or two.
Yeah, it is coming for our jobs, even without an intention or agency. But I was reading these kind of doomsday predictions, which are increasingly made by the makers themselves of AI. And I asked ChatGPT, how can we, you know, hold on to our humanity? And it says, well, we can hold on to our humanity, like, God, wink, wink, you know, you and I as humans. I'm like, okay, this is too much. This is too much. But it is a brave new world, as they say. I guess, you know, in closing, we do ask, as you think about the future, the kind of world we're leaving the next generation, the importance of the arts, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
I've also been asked a variation of this question, which is, what are you hopeful for? And my answer has been consistently, I'm hopeful in young people, because we go back to the example of Gaza and Palestine. It was the young people on college campuses who were putting their lives and livelihoods on the line and paying a price that most adults were not willing to pay. So there's stubborn idealism that's renewed from generation to generation, and a fearlessness that's born out of a lack of reality. You know, because when you're 18 to 21, you don't have oftentimes a full sense of the consequences that you're going to pay. Allows you to be brave in a way that older people are not necessarily able to do. So I do have hope in younger people. And of course, a lot of young people would say, well, the older folks should have more courage. And that's true. The younger people should not be the ones to have to carry this burden. But unfortunately, I do think that's true from generation to generation. And it does give us some kind of an optimistic approach to the previous question, because the dystopian possibilities of AI are already out there. Everybody's cognizant of that. But a generation raised with AI might be able to see creative solutions to it that an older generation might not. So one solution would be that if AI represents a continuing capitalist exploitation of all kinds of labor and a race to the bottom in terms of profit extraction, one possible solution is a more utopian possibility that AI could liberate human labor from the profit motive, and that we could have things like universal basic income so that we could all, you know, indulge in our creative impulses and be creative people, whatever that might mean. That's a utopian fantasy that younger revolutionaries might have a more fearless approach to doing. An older generation would say things like, that's not possible. We can't have universal basic income. But in fact, I think the only solution to a world in which everybody is ruthlessly exploited is, in fact, to take away the profit motive. And maybe the younger generation will have the imagination and the will and the courage to pull that off.
Yeah, that would be a lovely thing when we can start caring more about each other and not so much about money and just be committed to these other ideals. So thank you, Viet Thanh Nguyen, for inviting us into your imaginative world, showing us it's possible to see two or more sides to every situation by sharing your carpacious grief and empathy, and by sharing your commitment and shining a light on those stories of the unwanted, the unneeded, the unseen and invisible. With this, we can create a better tomorrow. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thanks so much for this conversation, Mia. It's always a pleasure.
The Creative Process podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Katie Foster and Henny Zhang. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk, with additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram at Creative Process Podcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.